Namam Vishmada Kishavasa Bhutale Shimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Sasvati Deve Gurvani Pachayane Nivashesa Sunivari Pashita Dishatarine Vansha Kalpata Vibhyasa Kepa Sindhubhya Vata Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudeva Gaura-bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, chapter 63, verse 34. Yeah. Sri Rudra Uvacha Swami Brahma Param Jyoti Swami Brahma Param Jyoti Gudam Brahma Nivanmaye Gudam Brahma Nivanmaye Yam Pasyantya Malatmana Yam pasyantya malatmana Akashamiva kevalam Akashamiva kevalam Sri Rudra uvacha Swami Brahma Param Jyotir Gudam Brahma Nivanmanye Yam pasyantya malatmana Akashamiva kevalam Alone. Brahma, the absolute truth. Param, supreme. Jyoti, light. Gudam, hidden. Brahmani, in the absolute. Vakmaye, in its form of language. In brackets, the Vedas. Yam, whom? Pasyanti, they see. Amala, spotless. Atmanaha, whose heart? Akasham, the sky. Eva, like. Kevalam pure. Translation. Sri Rudra said, "You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky." Responsively, Sri Rudra said, "You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky." Purport. The absolute truth is the source of all light and is therefore the supreme light, self-luminous. This absolute truth is explained confidentially in the Vedas and is therefore difficult for an ordinary reader to understand. The following statements quoted by Srila Jiva Goswami from the Gopal Tapani Upanishad show how the Vedic sounds occasionally reveal the absolute. Teho chur upashanam etasya paratmano govindasya kiladarino buhi. From the Purva Kanda 17. They, the four Kumaras, said to Brahma, "Please tell us how to worship Govinda, the Supreme Soul and the foundation of all that exists." Chaitanas Chaitananam, Purva Kanda 21. He is the chief of all living beings. And Tam Ha Devam Atma Viti Prakasham, Purva Kanda 23. One realizes the Supreme Godhead by first realizing one's own self. The great Acharya Jiva Goswami also quotes a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.10.48. Gudam Param Brahma Manusya Lingam, which refers to the Supreme Truth concealing in a human-like form. Since the Lord is pure, why do some people perceive Krishna's form and activities as impure? Acharya Jiva explains that those whose own hearts are impure cannot understand the pure Lord. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti further quotes the Lord's own instruction to Arjuna in Hari Vamsa. Tat param paramam brahma sava vibhajate jagat mamaiva tat kanam tejo kyatum ahasi bharata. Superior to that total material nature is the supreme Brahman from which this entire creation expands. O descendant of Bharata, you should know that the supreme Brahman consists of my concentrated effulgence. Thus, to save his devotee, Shiva now glorifies the Supreme Lord Krishna, his eternal worshipable master. The Lord's bewildering potency induced Shiva to fight with Lord Krishna, but now the fight is over, and to save his devotee, Lord Shiva offers these beautiful prayers. So, here we are at the point where Lord Shiva puts a word in for Banasura, so to speak. On his behalf, he is trying to save him by offering these prayers. And later on, after Lord Shiva offers the prayers, the Lord is saying, "Well, actually, I did not even plan to kill him, because after all, I gave Prahlad Maharaj a benediction that any of his descendants in his family line would not be killed by me. And actually, I only did this, you know, that I cut off all his arms except of four. I just did this in order to smash his pride a little bit, because he was simply getting too puffed up. And also, he's saying, I was doing that in order to get rid of his mighty army, which was just becoming a little too powerful, and which was burning the earth. So in that way we can see Krishna's pastimes are always performing so many, giving us so many instructions, and there's so many different angles and lessons to learn from. So first of all, now we can say, well, yes, that one lesson we can learn from is the compassion of a devotee, like Maharaj was saying yesterday. And actually it is said that a devotee is even more compassionate than the Lord. And a devotee can only get the Lord's mercy by another devotee putting a word in for him. You see, so that's why we say we cannot get Krishna's mercy directly, but only through the devotee. So this is one aspect. And naturally that pastime comes to mind with Lord Nityananda and Jagai and Madai, that Krishna actually was just about to kill them, but then Lord Nityananda put a word in for him, and therefore they got the Lord's mercy through Lord Nityananda. So that of course is a whole topic in itself, which would be interesting to talk about. But actually today I would like to speak on one aspect which is like kind of the foundation to that compassion. And that is how we actually do become a real servant. Because without having that attitude of being real servant, we actually cannot develop that quality of mercy and compassion. Not possible. And in the same way, just by coming to that point of becoming true servant, automatically we develop all those qualities. We actually don't have to separately endeavor for them. So if I go back a little bit, verse 28, there is a nice statement where actually the Shiva Dvara is speaking, and it says, all embodied souls must suffer as long as they remain bound to mature ambitions and thus averse to serving your lotus feet. So this is actually a very, very important principle we get here, that actually a living entity always has to suffer unless he becomes a servant, a true servant. So whenever we are in some suffering condition, it actually means we are not servant. So this is very interesting. And as soon as we agree to become the Lord's servant, then immediately our suffering is actually relieved. We are relieved from that suffering as soon as we agree to accept our real position, our real identity of being servant and nothing else. So, and this is also very nicely explained in another little verse in the third canto. Let me quickly find it. Yes, it says, O my Lord, the material miseries are without factual existence for the soul. Yet, as long as the conditioned soul sees the body as meant for sense enjoyment, he cannot get out of the entanglement of material miseries, being influenced by your external energy. So this very nice explanation where it says, actually, the material sufferings, they don't have any factual connection to the soul as such. There's actually no connection there. It is not suffering for the soul, actually, but only for the body. And as long as we think that this body is meant to give us enjoyment, then we suffer. But if we understand this body is simply meant as an instrument to serve the Lord, then we actually don't suffer. So it's quite interesting. Like, we can take an example. Let's say we break our leg. So if we think this body is meant for our enjoyment, then we will experience that situation as a suffering condition. We will think, oh, now I cannot do this, I cannot do that, I cannot, you know, dance in the kirtan, I cannot run around, I cannot do this, that. and then we lament. But if we simply see the body as meant to serve, then we will think, well, all right, I cannot serve with my leg now, but I still got the other parts of the body where I can serve, so let me serve in a different way. And we simply see the situation as a change of service situation. And then we realize, actually, this is not suffering. This is simply just a change of our service situation. So this is just an example to understand, yes, if we give up this mentality of being servant, then we always get some suffering due to the miseries which are always coming across us in this material world. But if we maintain that position as servant, then we simply see it as a change of service situation. So I had plenty of opportunities to remind me of this, you know, going through this chemotherapy and having surgery for cancer. And this actually helped me a lot, you know, that I was thinking, yes, all right, so now I have to give up my traveling, my preaching, but let me simply serve. So all right, this is just a change of service situation. Instead of traveling, preaching, so now I'm just preaching whoever comes my way in the hospital or whatever, you know. And then actually you don't experience that situation so much as suffering. You simply see it as a change of service situation. So in that way there's a very profound depth in that, those statements, you know, that the actual soul has nothing to do with material miseries. Now I remember once I was in Vrindavan and one devotee was giving Bhagavad Gita class in the evening in Prabhupada's room. And he was illustrating this point, and to the class he was bringing a mirror and a yellow cloth. And he put that yellow cloth around the mirror. So and then naturally when you look in the mirror, you see yellow reflecting from the yellow cloth. But of course the mirror is not yellow. In fact, the mirror has nothing to do with that cloth around, completely separate, completely different material, no connection actually. But just simply by being surrounded with that yellow cloth, it accepts seemingly that quality. And it was a very, you know, very explicit example, you know. I'm always remembering the cloth and the mirror, you know. This is actually the situation of the living entity and the material world. Actually, in actuality, we have no connection really with all, you know, the three modes of nature and all the sufferings that the three modes are bringing towards us. But simply due to identification and wrong consciousness, we accept it like the mirror is accepting the yellow color. And it seems like it has that same quality of the cloth, but in actuality it has not. So and this is exactly the position of the living entity in this material world. So and the same principle is also there on a more subtle platform, that, you know, we might have some position, some situation, and as soon as we see that meant to give us some pleasure in some way, then we lose that identification of servant, and then sooner or later we will experience suffering. Some change comes, some unexpected thing, we might lose our service, we might lose our position, we might have been, you know, temple president or head pujari or whatever, and then all of a sudden we lose it for some reason. So again, as long as we think that position is meant to give us pleasure, then we will lament and we will, you know, be attached to the position, we want to maintain it by hook or by crook. But if we simply remember, actually, my real position is servant, then we are not worried about it, because we can be completely confident that there will be always service for us, and we simply see it as change of service situation. And we simply think, all right, the devotees, for some reason, they don't want me to serve in this capacity, let me serve in another capacity, whatever they want, let me be servant. So then these unexpected changes will simply not give us any misery. So, and in that way we always maintain that position of being real servant. So in that way we can see, doesn't matter actually what happens to a devotee if he, you know, for some reason he cannot do what he would like to do. You know, very often we have some plans, we want to serve in such a way, but then we are not allowed to, for whatever reason that it may be. Or, as I said, we lose our position. All these things will not cause any suffering, any misery, because if we have that identification of simply being servant, if we give up that idea of expecting some enjoyment from that situation. So, you know, in that way we can say actually a devotee should never get offended. I always say, you know, being offended is not one of the Vaishnava qualities. So being offended always means we are not servant. You know? Because it means we think, well, how can they talk to us about like this? How can they do this to us? We should be treated like that. We should be allowed to do this, whatever. So this always means we are not servant. If we are really servant, we will never get offended. And the perfect example of that is, of course, Prahlad Maharaj. Even though Hiranyakashipu, he was mistreating him in so many ways, tried to kill him in so many ways, but Prahlad Maharaj, he never got offended. And he was always thinking of the benefit of his father. And then when Lord Nishignath asked him, you know, to desire a benediction, Prahlad Maharaj was saying these famous verses, you know, what it means to be a pure servant, not accepting anything in return, otherwise we're simply a merchant, no better than a businessman, just in exchanging service for some benediction, for some benefit. And he gives also that definition of what it means to be pure master. We were talking about that last time. That pure master doesn't give any benedictions just in order to establish and reinforce his supreme position. So, and then he says, actually the only thing I want is that you kindly forgive the offenses that my father has committed. That was his only concern. So that means real servant. That's the foundation of compassion, of mercy, to actually really come to this point of being real servant. And even you know, thinking, how can I serve that person? How can I elevate that person? Even if that person does so many inimical and bad activities towards me. So that's what it means, real servant. He never gives up that view of how can I serve that person, how can I act for the person's eternal benefit. So Prahlad Maharaj is very nice example. So in that way we can actually understand the root cause of any misery, of any conflict situation, of any suffering is always, I am not servant. If I was servant, then I would not experience it as suffering. And in that way we can understand clearly the solution to all conflicts, all miseries is to become servant, nothing else. It's not to try and change the external situation, but no, the solution is to change our consciousness and come to our real position of servant. And then we will not experience them as misery. So of course, it certainly is not an easy thing to come to this identification of being servant. It's not a cheap thing to actually be a real servant. Like we always sign the letters, you're servant, so and so, you know. And we think, yes, I'm servant, but actually, really speaking, if we really analyze our attitude, we are not servant. We are still businessmen, we are still merchants, always expecting something in return. So, and even if it is very subtle, even if it is most subtle. We don't even notice it. So subtle, just name, fame, respect, facilities, whatever, you know, can be very subtle, but usually we do expect something in return. And as soon as we expect something in return, we are enjoyer. We are not servant. We have given up our position of servant and we are actually enjoyer. That's the real conclusion, really. So it means in order to actually come to that identification of servant, we have to give up all other identifications. We have to give up the identification of, yes, I'm man, I'm woman, I'm brahmachari, I'm grihastha, I'm sannyasi, I'm whatever. I'm, you know, temple president, GBC. All these designations are actually material designations. They are false identifications, actually. But if we really analyze ourselves, we do strongly identify with them. Even as a devotee, even after hearing the philosophies for so many years, we still think, yes, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm a brahmachari, and so on. So, but actually our real identification should be servant and nothing else. All the other identifications we have to give up because they're false. They're not what we really are. They are upadis. So and that is not so easy. Not so easy. In fact, Gaurgiva Nimaraj describes that nicely. He says, the most dangerous moment of all moments is when we think, I am a Vaishnava. What to speak of, I am a senior Vaishnava, I am a senior devotee. Ooh, most dangerous moment of all moments. Why? Because as soon as we think, yes, I am Vaishnava, then we actually expect something. We expect some respect. And as soon as we expect some respect, we cannot give respect to one and all. That is kind of the meaning of Chinara Pisunichana. So, as soon as we have some other identification except I am servant, in one sense, we are actually expecting something in return. And it means, you know, we are in some kind of enjoying position. So we have to be very careful, you know, as soon as we notice this mentality comes in our mind that we think, yes, I'm a senior devotee, I have been around for so long. Oh, dangerous. You know, it means you have given up your position of servant. That's your real position. So that's why a devotee is never eager for any kind of titles or positions. No, the only position a devotee is eager for is to become servant and nothing else. And that is much easier if we don't have a position. That's why I'm always glad that I'm not having a position. And sometimes devotees want to offer me a position and I'm always running. No, no, no. Only position I want is being servant and nothing else. I don't want to accept another upadi, you know, some more baggage and wrong identifications because I know I'm not so advanced. As soon as I get a position, then, I'm giving up the position of servant for another position. And this is what happens very often, we can see. As soon as devotees get a position, then they identify with that position and they exchange it for the real position of being servant. They forget about that one and they accept another one. So in that way, you know, a devotee is never eager. All right, if he is offered some certain position, then he, you know, in order to serve, then he will humbly accept it. But he will always be in fear. Oh, please, Krishna, help me to remember my real position of being servant. Don't allow me to identify with some false upadi. So, because very easily it just happens, you know, you can observe in your mind as soon as you're accepting some different position, there's some flick in the mind, some switch gets flicked, you know, and you accept some other position. It does something to your mind, to your consciousness. In fact, we can even observe it when devotees get married. that while they're not married, while they're just associating, they have that attitude of being servant towards each other, and they think, yes, the lady thinks, yes, I want to serve this Prabhu, I want to, you know, cook for him and do this for him and that, and oh, when can I be, you know, his servant? And some way the man thinks, yes, I want to serve that Mataji, I want to protect her and give her guidance and this and that. So while you're not married yet, you still have the chance of having that identification with being servant. But then very often, as soon as people get married, then they accept the Zupati. Yes, now I'm husband, now I'm wife. And they give up the servant identification for another fourth identification. And then immediately the demands are starting. The husband thinks, well, I'm the husband, so why isn't she serving? Why isn't she behaving like this, like that? And then the demands are starting, you know, and the wife's the same. She thinks, well, I'm the wife, so he should treat me like this. He should buy me presents and be nice to me and this and that. So then immediately problems start. Just by forgetting our will identification with being servant and accepting another one, husband, wife. So it just seems to do something really to the mind very easily, you know. One actually has to be quite advanced not to be affected by these false designations, and very easily we get carried away with some kind of ambitions and personal motivations, you know. In fact, in regards to ambitious, there's one interesting thing Prabhupada says in one letter. He says, these two things are always side by side, Maya and Krishna. Krishna is service and Maya is sense gratification. Our duty is therefore to be very, very careful. The poison is personal ambition. The poison is personal ambition. That poisons everything. So, and again, ambition means we forget our real position of being servant, and we try and somehow or other be an enjoyer, be the master. So these things very easily sneak into the consciousness unless one is very advanced. Very easily they contaminate the consciousness and we forget our real position of being servant. And there's also another nice verse which is posted outside there about association, how to actually associate. And it's very interesting. Prabhupada gives a purport to that, and he says, you know, if we don't associate properly, that's the root cause of all miseries. I'll quickly read it. It's in fourth canto. It is said, every man should act like this. When he meets a person more qualified than himself, he should be very pleased. When he meets someone less qualified than himself, he should be compassionate towards him. And when he meets someone equal to himself, he should make friendship with him. In this way, one is never affected by the threefold miseries of this material world. Never affected by the threefold miseries, just due to proper behavior. And then in the purport it says, generally, when we find someone more qualified than ourselves, we become envious of him. When we find someone less qualified, we deride him. And when we find someone equal, we become very proud of our activities. These are the causes of all material tribulations. Prabhupada's conclusion. These are the causes of all material tribulations. So again, if we analyze, we can see, yes, these miseries are there. If we give up the position of being servant in from whatever position we are in. So if we meet a person more qualified, then we should be very pleased. We should offer service to him, either personal service or by hearing from him. It's also a very important service. So again, we are in that position of being servant. And if we meet someone equal, Now, if we meet someone less qualified than themselves, we should be compassionate towards him. So again, servant. We are servant to somebody who is less qualified by trying to be uplifting towards him. That's what it means to be compassionate, to somehow or other act for his eternal benefit. And if we meet someone equal, we should make friendship with him instead of becoming proud of our, you know, activities and try to be competitive. In fact, it is said in the association of equals, that's when mainly the anattas actually manifest, when they come out. That's why in Shaupati they have this recommendation that from our time of our 100% of time of association, 60 should be spent with equals, 20 with junior, and 20 with topmost, you know, guru, or godbrothers of guru, or whatever. So about 60% should be spent with equals. So that's very interesting. And that is because, you know, it is very easy to associate with the top, with guru, no problem. And very easy to associate with juniors, with young devotees. But in the equal association, that's when the envy comes out. If a person is envious, he cannot associate with equals. He cannot tolerate somebody equal next to him. He always has to be better, you know. And then there's always some conflict, you know, some difficulties in cooperation and so on, you know. That's why equal association is very, very important, very purifying. And also equals will let you know, when you go a little overboard, you know, you're becoming a little, you know, proud or whatever, you know. So we can analyze ourselves, you know, if we feel we find it a little difficult to associate with equals. That usually means, you know, there's something in our heart there, some anattas there, and we want to be the main person, you know. So that's why that recommendation is there. And yeah, then the anattas come out, they come to the surface. You know, when we associate with top or with young devotees, we don't notice it. The anattas are still there, but we simply don't notice it. They don't come up, they don't come to the surface. So that's why that recommendation is there, 60% with equals. So in other words, we can say actually the root cause of envy is that we want to be the supreme enjoyer. And as long as we are envious, we are not true servant. And true servant always acts in that capacity of trying to be uplifting to others. There's one nice definition of what it means to be non-envious. Comes actually from the Mahabharata. Non-envy means always desiring the welfare and advancement of all living beings, rather than to exploit them for one's own pleasure. In particular, one should desire the spiritual progress of others and act to assist them in that progress. That's what it means to be non-envious, always having that mood of being uplifting to others. And often our envy can be very, very subtle. Actually, I learned this lesson when I was traveling in Bangladesh. There's one devotee, Jagadguru Prabhu. Maharaj knows him also. He's a very wonderful devotee. He has so many nice qualities. And the topmost thing is that he's just so non-envious and so humble, even though he has so many nice qualities. In fact, I can say I have never met a person who has such natural humility and such natural non-envy. So we usually travel in a group of 8 or 10 boys, and we do some programs, temple programs, some meetings with the devotees, some public programs. So then on our travels, one devotee was joining us from Europe, and I knew him from before, and I must admit I was not so fond of him joining our party. You know, I thought he was not such an asset in our party. He was not a good singer and he was not a good speaker, and I kind of was thinking, why having him on the party? And also, if you travel in a smaller group, everybody really has to fit in the group, otherwise very easily it disturbs the atmosphere. So, and Jagadguru Prabhu, he didn't ask me before if it was all right that he would join. You know, usually we always discuss everything, but he knew my mind, so he didn't ask me. So all of a sudden that boy was there on the party, you know. And I was thinking to myself, what is this? Now we have him on the party. But I didn't say anything, you know, but I had negative feelings to this whole situation, you know. But then, while we were traveling, I watched this Jagadguru, how he was associating with this person. And he was just so sweet and so charming and so uplifting and so encouraging to him. You know, even though I knew he also thought that he was not such an asset, you know, because on one program, while that devotee was speaking, he turned to me and he said, not very attractive speech, you know, he was saying. So he also had that attitude, actually, you know, that he was not such an asset there to have him on the party. But then, you know, I saw him associating with this devotee and I was just thinking to myself, yes, this is what it means to be non-envious, you know. And here I was, I thought, why do we have this person here on the party, you know. But he was just so positive, so encouraging and so sweet with that devotee, you know. And I really felt ashamed. I was really thinking, yes, this is actually envy. If you somehow are negative to a person, you want to push him away, or no need for him here, you know. This actually, it's a subtle form of envy. Non-envious means, in any situation, you can be encouraging, you can be uplifting to that person. That's what it means to be non-envious, actually. And of course, Srila Prabhupada, he was setting that perfect example himself, that Prabhupada knew the art of always being uplifting to any person. So there was also this nice story which happened here in Melbourne. Actually, in Prabhupada's room, you can see above the lounge there, there's this beautiful painting of Radha and Krishna with a peacock and the rainbow around, you know. And there's a very nice description of how that painting was offered to Prabhupada in Kurma Prabhu's book about Prabhupada in Australia. And it was like, that painting was made by a devotee called Charmananda, and Prabhupada was visiting Melbourne, and that devotee was, you know, we would say he was a bit out of it, you know, he was a bit fringed out, he had long hair and a beard, and, you know, he was not properly practicing, you know. So, and then when Prabhupada visited, that devotee came in order to offer him this painting. And all the other devotees, they were thinking, wow, you know, let's see how Prabhupada will get on his case, you know, for having this long hair and this beard and looking so out of it. Let's witness that, you know. So they were all hanging around, you know, peeking out the different corners and doors, you know, in order to see what Prabhupada would say when he would give him that painting. So then Kurma Prabhu describes it so nicely, you know. And so this Charmananda came, you know, up the stairs with his big painting, you know, carrying it to Prabhupada's room. So, and then when Prabhupada saw Charmananda, he was just laughing and he was ruffling his hair, you know, and tickling him on the beard, you know, and saying, what is this, you know. And then Charmananda said, it's a beard, Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada said, so why do you have this beard? And Charmananda gave this answer. He was saying, because I find it easier to relate to people if I look like them. which is a bit of a stupid answer for a devotee, you know. But he gave that answer, and then he kind of realized that it was a bit of a stupid thing to say. So he just started laughing and saying, actually, Prabhupada, I don't know why I've got a beard, you know. So Prabhupada and Swaminanda, they both were laughing. So, you know, with a very sweet way, you know, Prabhupada did give some attention to the situation that he had a beard and long hair, but he didn't get on his case. So then Prabhupada, he was looking at the painting, and, you know, and Swaminanda offered it to him and said, oh, you know, this is for you, Prabhupada, I painted it. And Prabhupada was glorifying it and saying, oh, this is so beautiful, and this is what I want to see every morning, first thing when I wake up, I want to see this painting, you know. And then Prabhupada said a nice thing. He said, I can write, you cannot write. You can paint, I cannot paint. So let's work together for the pleasure of Krishna. You know, very, very sweet, you know. So Prabhupada knew this art of really being encouraging to anybody, you know, not by smashing him, getting on his case, you know, but he knew that art, and this is what it means to be true servant, completely non-envious, to always know how to be encouraging to every living entity. And Prabhupada really had that ability, that whoever came in contact with him felt uplifted. So that's basically what it means to become true servant. So in that way, you know, becoming true servant brings all the other qualities to a devotee, that quality of compassion, of mercy, of being non-envious. And it also brings that situation that we will not experience miseries as suffering, because we see them simply as a change of service situation. So in that way, the only position we should be really striving and hankering for is that position of servant that will bring all the solutions to our miseries and suffering, and it will automatically help us to develop all other nice qualities. So I'll finish there. Maybe somebody wants to add something. Right. I feel embarrassed sitting here speaking in front of you. So maybe you want to...
We may, just like a train, we come to a train station, a timetable. So when we're thinking in a mechanistic way, we're thinking, I've been a devotee for so many years, I've put my, I've got my position, etc. Then we begin to think that respect should come our way, or this Krishna will reciprocate at a certain time for us. But this mood of service, as you're expressing nicely, is a home, a mood of detachment. And, as what Christ said about my will be done, that that's a concern policy. So that's a secret. The open secret to success is just to become a servant of the servant.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I mean, very often as a young devotee, we don't see it like that, you know, especially servant of the devotees. We just see, you know, me and the deity, me and guru, and so on, and we think, yes, I can make it up there by somehow or other trying to serve them, and we tend to forget about the devotees, you know. but really, the only way to success and joy and happiness is to really become servant of the devotees. Nothing else. And if we have that attitude, you know, then automatically that detachment develops, you know, because we will simply be happy to serve in this capacity, that capacity. We are not worried about it, you know. We simply want to serve, and we always think, how can I serve the devotees around me? What can I do in order to inspire them and to uplift them somehow or other, you know?
At the time of death, everything is taken away, and one time the service continues.
Yeah, and in that way, Dasa is simply just a journey into another, maybe a little unknown service situation. You know? But that we can be sure of, pretty much, you know, if we have been for so many lives, so many years in the association of devotees serving them, then we have a good chance that wherever we will go, we will be again with the devotees, and we will again be able to serve. And that way we are not even so worried where we will really go, you know, whether it will be the spiritual world or not, or this and that, you know. So main thing is let me be with devotees and let me get an opportunity to serve. You know. What else?
Maharaj said, at the time of death, the real test, and I was thinking of that group, Samadhi Goswami group, servant of the servant of the servant, they were like, first cry there, and tears were rolling in my eyes. This is beautiful, you know. And you can get inside of the ISKCON, what is Prabhupada's mood and how he was serving his spiritual monks.
I mean that mood of servant is also really protecting us against, you know, personal ambition and pride and so on. Like Prabhupada, there's also that story when Prabhupada arrives at the airport and all the devotees are paying obeisances, and then there's a reporter coming, and often the reporters were always asking in a very challenging mood, you know. They were asking Prabhupada on different things, and the reporter was saying, oh, why are all these people paying obeisances to you? You know, what is the meaning of this? And there was this envy there, you know, who are you anyway that everybody, you know, falls flat on the ground? And Prabhupada gave this answer, I'm a tax collector, you know, I'm simply collecting obeisances. I'm simply collecting them and passing them on, like a tax collector also doesn't think the money is for him, but he sees himself simply a servant, you know, and passing on those obeisances. So that's the mood of a pure devotee. He never thinks, yes, these people are paying obeisances to me because I'm so great or whatever. No, he is simply collecting them and giving them to Krishna. Yeah? Described in Korma Prabhu's book. This book by Korma Prabhu is really my favorite book about Prabhupada's pastimes. There's so many instructive things in there, you know, and so nicely described. You really feel like you're right there and you get Prabhupada's association, you know, very nice. Well, there's different ways of seeing oneself equally. I mean, in one sense you can say a devotee who is really humble, he will never see himself equal. He will always see himself as junior, you know, to others because of his humility. Even amongst equals, he will think, no, actually this other person is more advanced, superior, you know. But I mean, usually we, you know, according to the etiquette, we see equality, you know, first of all in age of our mature body, you know, then automatically if a person is a little older, we do take a respectful mood towards a person. And then of course when they joined, when they became initiated and when they got Brahman, you know. So usually devotees who join around the same time, we consider them as equals in one sense, you know, although, as I said, you know, if we are truly humble, we wouldn't see them as equal, and we always, even amongst equals, that's the point, even amongst equals, we should accept that mood of serving the other person, of servant, you know, and this is hardest there, on that relationship, you know, because that competitive mood comes in, you know, and we want to show all what I'm all doing and so on. So that pride comes in, like Prabhupada describes in the purport, you know. So,
what was the question?
She was asking about equal devotees. I was reading that verse which is posted outside, you know, how a devotee should behave when he meets seniors, he should be happy. When he meets equals, he should make friendship. And when he meets younger devotees, he should be compassionate. And I was saying that in Chaupati Temple, they recommend 60% out of all associations should be with equals. Yeah. Because in that relationship, the anatta is surfacing very nicely, you know, the pride, the envy, all that comes out, you know, in difficulties of associating with equals, you know, and it's much easier to associate with the top, with guru or with very senior devotees, and much easier to associate with the youngers. But when we have to associate with equals, often more difficult. So she was asking who is our equal, you know, like that. Yeah, so basically it means, you know, who joined around the same time and so on, you know, and who's also a similar age in that way, like that, you know. Like that. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, as I said, if we're really humble, we wouldn't consider ourselves equal, you know. We always consider ourselves as junior, and we are eager to serve.
That's why we call
the
devotees
Prabhu. That's right. That's
right.
Yeah. And even younger devotees, we should also call Prabhu, because that helps us to remember our position of being servants. You know, so, and this is not so developed, especially in the Western world. I mean, this is also one thing you really learn in Bangladesh, you know. They always call each other Prabhu, even the Bhaktas, even the senior devotees call the Bhaktas Prabhu. Yeah, it is very nice. Like after Mongoladi, they announce who is leading the kirtan, who is giving the classes and so on. And they always announce, so today Bhagavatam class is given by, you know, what example? Uddhava Prabhu. Or they say by Krishnagaja Das Brahmachari Prabhu. Yeah, it can be, sometimes it's like that it's a little formal and so on, you know. But then, I mean, my experience, you know, is, at least, you know, from my travels in Bangladesh, that people do have that respectful mood grained into their heart, you know. And it just goes according to their grain, so to speak, you know. I mean, even little things like, in Bangladesh, no younger devotee would just take up the madanga and start leading a kirtan in the presence of senior devotees. You know, they wait until they're asked, until they're invited. You know, and the first go should always be given to the senior devotees, and then they invite, okay, you lead, you know, like this, or giving classes or something like that, you know. And these things are really ingrained into people's hearts, you know.
It's right from birth. Yeah, it is.
And sometimes it's nearly a bit annoying, you know. Like, again, that devotee I was talking about, Jagat Guru, he's a very nice singer, you know. Very beautiful voice, very sweet. But because he's a young devotee, he's only 24 or something, he often doesn't want to sing in the presence of other devotees, but then often the kirtans are so, oh, you know, and I will sometimes get annoyed, say, well, why don't you sing, you know, this is service, you should be serving the devotees, you know. So, but this is just so ingrained into their hearts, you know, they feel very uncomfortable, and they feel they're doing the wrong thing, you know, by transgressing these etiquettes, you know.
Yeah.
actually it has a name, Mariyad. I've forgotten the Sanskrit term, but it's actually an offence to transgress and overstep
senior.
And the culture is very cautious again, because it's related to your teachers, well, to your parents first, to your senior brothers and sisters. Then to your teachers. Respectful people
in the community. It's there. And I mean, that respectful mood is necessary if we want to learn from seniors, if we want to actually really get the most benefit of their association. We have to have that respectful mood. Otherwise, you know, if we just think, nothing special and big deal and I'm just as good as they are and so on, then how will we get some benefit? You know, we will miss out. We will not be able to learn from their experience, you know, if that respectful mood is not there. So, in one sense, you know, it is really, really important to develop that, you know. And it creates a nice cultural mood, you know, a certain sweetness there, you know. It does.
Mother, this was a very, very nice lecture. Wonderful lecture. One thing what I wanted to know, when you were talking about any illness, that comes very naturally when you are advanced in Krishna consciousness. Now, there are a lot of people, say for example, coming to temple, devotees won't treat them, you know, at that equal level.
At that what level?
At the level, equal level.
Yeah.
But as then Krishna tells the Gita, then you just give this knowledge to any new devotee, like any person who does not know anything in Krishna consciousness, then become very, very clear to him. This is a verse, it's been spoken by Krishna. Then what my point is that some moment the devotee does not treat, as you are saying as well, that properly, and they pop up with that knowledge and sort of things. So in that situation, what should they do?
Well, you know, we can say Krishna is very expert in, you know, adjusting things and in smashing the pride of living entities, you know, as we can see also here at Banasura, you know, so it might not be our position to try and adjust that, especially if we are also a younger devotee. So this is the position of guru or, you know, authority who is doing that service of trying to, you know, to take care of devotees' spiritual life. So it wouldn't really be our position to adjust that. That is between him and Krishna. And sooner or later, Krishna makes some arrangements. I mean, he does it all the time, you know. I'm sure we all have that experience, how Krishna's, you know, making a fool out of us in some ways, you know, in certain situations, and doing something in order to smash our ego a little bit.
And that's about the false ego you're pointing, isn't it?
Mm.
Because it's like a very subtle level.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, false ego means you're hanging on to some false identification. That's what it is, the false ego. You don't understand. Yes, I am servant. You think you're something else, you know. So that's why it is false. A false identification, a false ego. There's also one nice thing where it says, mana or false prestige, it's in 10th canto, mana or false prestige is certainly an anxiety-ridden burden for the conditioned soul. A falsely proud person is not truly peaceful or satisfied because his understanding of himself is false and inflated. When a servant of the Lord becomes asat or irreligious, the Lord saves him from impiety by breaking the false prestige that has led him to the offensive or sinful activity. So that's the thing, a proud person, he can never be peaceful, you know, because his view of himself is always false and inflated. And therefore he's always in anxiety, you know, how to maintain that false picture of himself, you know. So, but when you become servant, you actually become peaceful, you know. Actually, in that regard, we were yesterday at breakfast prasadam, we were talking about giving class, and I was saying to the Matajis, actually, years ago, I could never imagine to give class. I was so shy and mental, I couldn't even get up and make an announcement or something, you know, completely shy and mental, you know. And so and then they were asking, well, how did you overcome it? And it actually is, again, you overcome these things by becoming servant, you know. If you're worrying about yourself, what you look like, you hang on to some false, puffed up picture there of yourself, and you're worrying what they think and how you look like and this and that, well, then you will be in anxiety and you will get all nervous and, you know, actually that is a sign of the mental and bodily false ego platform. But if you simply think of, how can I serve the devotees? Then you lose all these things, you know, and all of a sudden you can say something and you simply hope that it will be of some little inspiration, you know. So even there, you know, this thing of being servant puts you in your actual position, you know, and then you...
Serving devotees as well as non-devotees, because then only you can become very, very dear to Krishna.
Mm.
Because devotee is already on a platform who are already demanding.
Yeah, but still, they also need to be served. In fact, Prabhupada said to preach to devotees is even more important than preaching to non-devotees. Because this is a mistake we often make. We think, so now he is a devotee, now he doesn't need any more care and attention and nourishment. He's already one of ours. So, and then we demand, you serve, you do this, you do that. But no, it's an ongoing process. Mm, that's right. So that's why we constantly have to try and aspire to become a real devotee and nurture each other.
Yes.
You know? Yeah?
Yeah, just about preaching. A lot of preaching is just making friends with
the
people.
Yeah.
Not through the devotees.
Yeah.
It's with the non-devotees.
Mm.
And, you know, it's going to be... Just making friends with people actually has a huge effect. So, that last point that you made is a good one. Public speaking is rated as being one of the top fears of people. You know, actually standing in front of a group of people and speaking, that's the greatest fear that people have. Even greater than dying. But, you know, as a devotee matures and as they grow up, then, you know, they get many opportunities to speak and to, you know, say, here to simply make announcements and stuff like that. And gradually, as we mature and get more experience, then we become more comfortable with these activities. It's not difficult to do.
Mm.
One just has to learn how to do it.
Yeah, but that, you know, seeing oneself, at least for me, it helps me a lot, you know, just to see myself as servant when I speak, you know, and then you don't really worry if you make a fool out of yourself or if you can't answer some question or you don't know anything, whatever, or you don't worry. You simply want to serve and you simply hope, well, whatever I can serve, they're just going to have to accept that, you know. Well, that's what it is, you know. Then you don't worry about these things, you know. You simply want to serve. Yeah, and relationships, yeah, that is the basis of everything, actually. Not only in our preaching, even within management, we can also say, if we have strong, affectionate relationships, then management is at our fingertips, you know. Then people want to serve, they want to help out, they want to give whatever they can give, you know, if there's some sheltering relationships there. But if that relationship is not there, then we are holding back, you know. Because ultimately it's difficult to serve Krishna directly, you know. Krishna is for most of us pretty remote. And even to serve Guru is also pretty remote. So in actuality we are serving the devotees, and that's what we should be doing. And, you know, that relationship has to be there, then we will be eager to serve, you know, because we feel indebted to that person, because he is doing so much for us. Then we simply want to reciprocate and we want to give whatever we can give.
I just don't understand something. When we showed the example of the young boy coming from the school to join the team, I didn't understand how, you know, the feeling that wasn't playing the world, preaching the world, the limitations can be empty.
Well, because basically, you know, if I take myself, you know, because I had that little bit of negative feeling there, it basically envy, because somebody is inferior to you and you use that, you know, in order to push him down and control and be supreme, you know, and that is envy. It's a subtle form of envy to feel like that, you know, to do, as it says in the word, in the verse there, you know, you deride inferior people, you know, that's a sign of envy, that you think, who is he anyway, I don't want him on the party, he's not an asset, you know, there's envy there. I didn't realize it myself so much, I only realized that when I saw how this other devotee was dealing so nicely with him, I realized, yes, this is what it is to be non-envious. And my feeling actually was envy. You know, that I didn't want him on the party, you know.
So, to deal with this kind of envy, do you just serve the devotees?
Well, you have to have the intense desire of wanting to become servant. You know, that should be our meditation. How can I serve the devotees? How can I become true servant? Yeah, that's right. And you will recognize how you can serve. If you don't even have the desire to serve, you will not even recognize the opportunities, you know. But if you have that mood, if you always think, how can I serve that devotee? Then you wouldn't act like that you think, this boy is no use on our party, you know. Then you would think, how can I inspire him? How can I be uplifting to him, you know? Huh?
If you can't sort of be inspiring to that person, do you just serve them until that mood comes?
Yeah, you somehow or other find a way to serve him. And somehow or other be inspiring to him, you know. So we can really say, you know, if a person who can be always inspiring and uplifting to a person, that's a sign of non-envy. But if you know, if we push a person aside and we are suppressing and not inspiring to a person, that is usually a sign of envy, you know. It is subtle. Not what? Well, that's the thing. If you're really expert and really non-envious, you find, I mean, you look at Prabhupada, you know. You know, you can read even non-devotees who had not much connection with Prabhupada, but when they met Prabhupada, they always felt inspired and uplifted. You know. So that's the thing. An expert and non-envious person knows that art of being inspiring, you know, without pushing the person for some service or this or that, you know. That's the thing, that's the expertise, you know. If you're really non-envious, you know how to be uplifting.
I also wonder, you know, about negating natural pride. Does that come from, like, other lifetimes, or is that just from the lifetime?
Well, obviously it comes from many lifetimes, you know. For so many lifetimes we've been accepting these false designations, you know.
Keep
Yeah. And a person who has that natural humility, it also comes from previous lifetime, you know. So, but that just means they were working already earlier on that, you know. So that doesn't mean it's an excuse and we can say, well, it comes from previous life, what can I do? No, so at least now we have to start working on it and become true servant, you know. And then next lifetime we will continue on that position, you know, where we left off, like that. All right, so it's 9:05, we'll finish there. Thank you very much. Ganja Srimad Bhagavatam ki.